Okay, welcome everyone. I'm Tony Cook. I'll be chairing today. We're there, so hopefully everyone's in the right place. If I could just briefly introduce Jennifer. Jennifer's Chief Actuary, Wealth Management at the Commonwealth Bank. She's over 20 years' experience in the financial services industry, including work for life insurance companies, asset managers, and for a financial services consultant. She's written a number of papers to the Institute over the years, and including choice of risk discount rate, valuation of life insurance companies, and asset liability modelling for life and general insurers. The format today, Jennifer, is a presentation she would like to run through. It will go from anywhere between 25 and 30 minutes, and there'll be time for questions at the end of that. So with no further ado, I'll pass over to Jennifer.
Okay. So thanks, Tony. As Tony said, I've got a presentation. I've written what will become a paper, but I don't think any of you have read it, so I'll assume no knowledge. So the basis for this economic capital presentation is I've been very interested in economic capital over a number of years, but particularly trying to understand how different types of companies do it, particularly life insurers, general insurers, and banks, who are all really trying to achieve the same thing but come at it from quite different angles in terms of the heritage they've had of measuring risk and managing risk. So I've talked about it as a common currency for risk, and what I'm going to do is really run through where I see the major things in terms of economic capital and where the inconsistencies might lie. And as I go through the presentation, I'll talk about the differences between the different kinds of companies. So the agenda is really, what is economic capital? Why would you measure it? And then how do you calculate it, which is where we start getting into the nuts and bolts of differences. Measures of confidence, that's a really key part of economic capital. What is our confidence level that we think about, and how do we then translate that into an economic capital measure? And then the most important point, there's no point in having economic capital if you're just calculating something. How do you use it to manage within an ARM framework? So just quickly, a definition that I use. Not everyone would use the same definition. Economic capital is to assist companies in appropriately measuring the rate of return a company is getting in proportion to the risk it's taking. So it's really to give you a common currency for risk. So if one part of the company is taking a risk, what kind of return do we think that they need to get to make that risk worthwhile? Back before we measured economic capital, we did kind of instinctively understand that you should get more return for risk, but we didn't have a way of measuring it, and most importantly in a diversified financial services company, a way of actually saying this risk is worth more than this risk, and therefore you should get more return in return for taking it. So I guess first of all, what economic capital is not? It's not regulatory capital. Regulatory capital is the amount of money that the regulator has determined that any of the institutions we're talking about needs to hold, but it's generally not as specific to the risks of an institution as economic capital will be. The capital for particular risks in a regulatory capital framework are almost always calculated more broadly, and the definition of the risks are more systemic than the institutional one. So regulatory capital is often very closely related to economic capital, but it's not the same thing. I guess the other thing is, in my view, it's not the value of the organisation, the value being the franchise value, the value of the future profits. There's no particular reason why economic capital, the amount of capital we think you need to hold for risk, should be the same as the value of the organisation. But obviously the returns that we're trying to get should be related to the risk we're taking. And it's not the capital resource. Economic capital is a measure of what we think we'd like to have, not how much capital we actually have right now. Most companies you'd expect to have the capital resources available to them are actually more than the economic capital of the business. So capital resources are things like the net assets, the value of future profits, some other assets that might not be recognised for accounting purposes, and might not include some assets which are recognised for accounting purposes that would be actually no use in a risky scenario. So what's the point of economic capital? Although I said it's not regulatory capital, depending on your regulatory framework, it is actually worthwhile for a company to understand it from a solvency perspective. But it's generally more worthwhile in a light regulatory framework. If a company is in a regulatory framework where they need to hold a substantial degree of regulatory capital, from that perspective, they're more interested in making sure they hold enough capital to not breach regulatory capital rather than actually using working out their capital that they hold totally on the basis of economic capital. So in a country with a regulatory environment where there's a less developed regulatory framework, or it feels a bit light for the company, you might use economic capital to choose how much capital you actually hold for the risk of the business. But most companies, I'd say, in an Australian environment would be saying the actual capital we have, the actual capital resource we have, is related to our risk of breaching regulatory capital, not so much the underlying risks. But the main purpose that I want to talk about today is to enable the good risk-reward trade-offs across the organisation. So I put some kind of generic points there in pricing for risk, portfolio optimisation, investment assessments, but just to give you a sense of what those might be. Is it worth investing in systems that will reduce our operational risk? So if we invest in a system which we expect will make our processes smoother, we might get cost benefits, but we also might get risk benefits from doing that. Economic capital will help you make that kind of approach if you've appropriately allocated the operational risk capital. The treasury operation looks like it's making a high contribution to profit, but is it high enough given the risk they're taking is another question that economic capital will help you answer. And I guess the diversification question, adding a general insurance operation might add diversification, but it might be making a lower margin than the rest of the business. But it's possible that overall diversification, when you look at the change in risk, will be worth it anyway, because the marginal increase in return compared with the marginal increase in risk makes it worthwhile. So an economic capital framework will help you answer those kinds of questions. So the broad characterisation of those questions is pricing for risk, portfolio optimisation, and making the right investment assessment for new decisions. But I guess and I'll come back to this later, the economic capital approach will work if all financial decisions in an organisation involve looking at return on economic capital. So it's not just one of those things that gets pulled out every now and again. It's actually part of the framework of how the organisation's managed. So when the management of the organisation, not just the finance or the risk people, actually naturally use economic capital as part of the way in which they talk about the business. And measurement of the financial performance of each line of business or each person, if they have a KPI related to financial performance, needs to have some kind of economic capital measure to really embed it into the DNA of the organisation. So I guess I'm about to talk about a lot of theoretical things, but before I do that, I just wanted to make the point at the bottom of this slide that perfect theoretical accuracy is much less important than implementing an economic capital framework throughout an organisation that people believe in. But one of the things that we need to make sure is that people do believe and buy into it, and that's where we get to some level of theoretical accuracy, because otherwise you spend your life discussing the assumptions and disagreeing with them. So first of all, how do you calculate it? Those of you who went to John Evans' presentation yesterday might recognise this slide. So we work for the same company, so we've got the same picture of distributions. There are a number of different ways, but they always end up with some kind of measure of confidence. Now, interestingly, if you look across different types of regulatory entities, the measures of confidence in a regulatory level are quite different. Basel framework requires a probability of not meeting liabilities of 1 in 1,000. General insurance companies, the requirement for internal models is 1 in 200. Capital adequacy standard for life insurers is 1 in 400. So we've already got a difference in culture of how people think of extreme risks just in the regulatory frameworks. And I think that tends to actually play out in the way people measure economic capital as well. So what I've got here is just a picture of a distribution, and I think this distribution, the types of distributions we've got here are ones that we'd all be familiar with from different parts of financial services organisation. You've got an expected level of economic loss, and then a potential unexpected loss for which capital shall be held, and then a potential unexpected loss in which we're not going to hold capital against. And you can see that different distributions, the choice of where you put that line of what you're actually measuring can actually make a difference to relativity between types of risk as well as to the ultimate capital that you might hold. So, for example, a general insurance example would be that if you're looking at very extreme risks, earthquakes affect home contents portfolios quite a lot more than they affect motor portfolios, for example. So if you get if you're looking at a very extreme point, then you're more likely to say that home contents are risky, assuming you have your reinsurer hasn't got any cat cover, then you have got than if you've got a motor portfolio. Whereas a motor portfolio might have a lot of profit volatility, but not as much a very extreme risk. Similarly for the, I think at least in an Australian context, it's probably reasonable to say that the corporate lending has a much more extreme tail than the personal lending book of a major bank. So you might actually get different relativities between the types of portfolios depending on where you choose that actual level of extreme. And I suspect that that's partly the reason for the differences between the types of portfolios, but I'll go in a little bit more detail when we talk about calculation. So, as I said before, differences across industries reflect different measures of confidence. So banks tend, as a rule, to choose a single point very much at the extreme of a distribution. General insurers, from what I've seen, tend to choose a single point that's quite close, you know, kind of at the 1 in 100, 1 in 200 level, but then use different ways of dealing with that. So hold a multiple of the capital required at that single point, or look at a tail VAR, which I'll explain at the moment, or various other ways of saying 1 in 100, 1 in 200, some kind of level at that point, and then choose a multiple. Life insurers, a little bit depends on the heritage, tend to choose a single point, but probably not as extreme a single point as the banks, I guess because they've got less confidence in the tail than the banks might do. So why is that? I guess I've got a few hypotheses about that. Partly the consequences of failure. I think it's reasonable to say that banks probably matter to the financial services system more than life insurers and general insurance. They all matter. As we all know, when we saw HIH failing, a failure of insurance companies is a big deal for an economy, to banks probably worse. Shareholder expectations. I suspect shareholders do expect their banks to be more conservative than general insurers or life insurers if you look at the way in which betas work. Ratings agencies are not actually consistent across industries. Many banks would choose a measure of economic capital defined by risk of default. We want to be a AA risk, so that's a risk of default of 0.03, 0.05, something like that. But rating agencies generally only expect general insurers to hold cat cover up to a much lower than level of that, say 1 in 250 or 1 in 300, to give them a AA rating. So that's actually a little bit inconsistent between how a rating agency might look at the tail between the different lines of business. I think, you know, there's a reasonable spread of people in the room, but I do find that across those different industries there's not as much kind of cross-fertilisation of ideas as you might expect, and rating agencies are probably just as siloed as everyone else. But I guess the last point is probably the one that I want to spend a bit of time on, which is the confidence in the models. And I think that was touched on in the first plenary session yesterday morning. I think that historically there's been more willingness to look at the tail on the banking side than there has been on the other sides. So most general insurers won't actually look at a model that much further beyond the 1 in 250, 1 in 300 level. They'll tend to then say, well, okay, well, how much do we need there, and let's take a multiple. So, for example, the kind of event that would give you a 1 in 1,000 or 1 in 2,000 probability from in a catastrophe model for a general insurer is probably a cyclone Tracy hitting Cairns or an earthquake in Botany Bay, that kind of thing. They're not, those most extreme types of events are not ones that are directly modelled. People tend to hold capital at a lower level but a higher multiple of it. Whereas on the banking side, I think there has been more confidence in the extreme tail of models in the past. So a quote, which I'm sure you've all heard before, August 5th, 2007, during a conference call with investors, various high-ranking AIG officials stressed the near absolute security of the credit default swaps. The risk actually undertaken is very modest and remote, said AIG's chief risk officer. Now, it's easy to quote people in hindsight, but I think there has been a more general view that the tail of the distribution is more able to be relied on the banking side. But I guess the key to this kind of modelling is always about the tail. And the real question here is how do we deal with the fact that the tail is very, very uncertain? And my view is it doesn't really matter what kind of risk you're modelling. Obviously, it matters more if the risk is very, very skew But even risks that aren't particularly skewed, you have to be pretty careful when you get out to the tail, because the kind of events you're talking about are events that haven't actually happened in your experience, probably. So my background is very much in the life insurance side. When we start talking about 1 in 2,000 events, I always start talking about Black Plague. After all, that has happened in the last 2,000 years, and one third of the population of Europe died. That's not a risk that life insurers generally hold capital against. And most people say, oh no, I wouldn't expect you to hold it against Black Plague. So I guess my view is you're better off trying to look at the bits of the distribution that you've got a reasonable level of understanding of and comfort in, and then hold multiples of that. Now that's a little bit different from what I was saying before about how what you choose at the very tail can actually change your mix. And it's important to really try and understand the tail as well, but with the understanding that you're never going to get it right, and certainly not right enough to hang your hat on how much capital you should hold. So with the general insurance, a number of general insurance papers I've read talk about using either the multiple of a 1 in 100 or 1 in 200 point, or using a tail VAR, which I think is a good compromise in trying to understand the tail but not to put too much confidence in it. So the tail VAR exists is effectively the expected loss beyond the 1 in 100 or 1 in 200 point. So it's that shaded point up there. And I think that was more likely to give confidence in the distribution around the business. So once you've chosen... one point there, and I've got some suggestions for further reading at the end. I'm sure many of you will have read Nassim Taleb's book, Black Swan. I actually think his earlier book, Fooled by Randomness, is a better one to read on this topic, just trying to understand how little we know about the extreme probability of extreme events. We tend to ignore the odd things that might cause something in the tail, so highly recommended reading there. So what do we do with the confidence level? I guess what we do there is it depends a bit on how we decide to use it. Either we hold some kind of multiple of the point that we've chosen, or we hold the capital that we need for that extreme event, or some combination of the two. I guess the most important thing is to make it consistent across the organisations and to understand what that common currency means. So if we're effectively working out what our loss is at a 1 in 100, clearly we'd need far more capital than that, but we might be prepared to say, lose 20% of our capital at a 1 in 100 point or some multiple of that. So you could say that we should hold five times our 1 in 100 capital. It comes back to risk appetite. There was the presentation that John Evans and Zach Roberts did yesterday talked about the risk appetite. There's a number of different ways in expressing risk appetite. It's about not being able to pay your liabilities or not meeting regulatory capital. There are a number of different ways of expressing it. But understanding what it is that you're prepared to hold capital against, and then how you can translate it into the distribution, is then you then can translate that into the economic capital for a particular line of business. So I guess a bit more on the types of risk that we're modelling. Operational risk, often extraordinarily skewed distributions based on very little data. There are various data sources across the world that you can get, which have loss types around the world, but the trouble with that is everyone defines it slightly differently, so trying to translate that into your own organisation is difficult. The real trick there is to get the right balance between having something that actually will move with action. So if you do actually take action to reduce risk, you should get a capital benefit from it, but can also be tied back to some kind of distribution that isn't just people putting their finger in the air and saying, this is what I think the risk is. Credit risk, there's very, very substantial data, but often from fairly short time periods, because people have been trying to get very good, rich data, which means that the rich data is only as far back as you've been collecting it, not necessarily over the last 50, 100 years. Mortality risk is obviously substantial data on that, but fairly short time periods and without pandemics. I've split general insurance into the property and casualty risk. I guess the property risk has reasonably good data, I'd say, and the catastrophe models that happen give you quite a good understanding of the reasonably extreme, not extremely extreme events. But whereas the casualty risk, the asbestos type claims, is probably much harder. So I guess my point there is, you know, models do become much less reliable at the tail, and it's important to really recognise that in how you choose to use those. So I guess the question is, do the approaches make a difference? And I think they do make a difference to risk relativities, but I suspect they also make a difference to the level of confidence in the general business around the model. I've certainly seen operational risk models based on a 1 in 2000 point that people tend to treat as black boxes rather than really creating the buy-in. The more the models are based on the type of event that people can understand and believe, even if they're based on models of that, the more you get the buy-in to it. And I guess, so my view is that the whole tail var or multiple of a more not quite as extreme event will give you a better outcome. So what about the balance sheet? This is probably the other major difference between types of organisation. A lot of companies tend to just assume that the net assets is the right starting point, end of story. The net assets in different types of business have very, very different levels of conservatism hidden in them. So, for example, general insurance. General insurance, the requirement is to hold at least 75% confidence interval. Many companies hold more. Life insurance, if we've got a product that's making a lot of money, then it'll have profit margins hidden in there. If we've got a product that we sold at a loss, then there'll be no product margins. So we're on the range of 50th percentile to, say, 99th percentile, just in the net assets. There'll be assets on the balance sheet with no value in a stress scenario. Goodwill, some might argue DAC is probably to some degree in that category. And then there'll be assets on some balance sheets around a financial services company that are not really marked to market, or their marking to market is different in the way in which it's treated in different balance sheets. So that's a complex issue. Really, if you move away from the very defined balance sheet that everyone uses to report profit to the market, then you do open huge cans of worms in comparability. But if you're trying to compare things that aren't actually consistent in terms of the level of conservatism, you also have a huge issue in comparability. So the question there is, how much of the trade-off of simplicity using the net assets from the accounts versus buy-in, because the whole point of this is to get buy-in, to get people to actually behave so that they get return for risk, are you willing to make? Diversification benefits is another interesting point that people try and deal with. How do you allocate them, and how important are they? Should they all just be held at the centre, or should different business lines get the benefit of them? So example from my organisation is we have a very small general insurance company, which we're pretty comfortable is fairly uncorrelated with everything else we do, because it's basically personal lines. How much of the diversification benefit that we do bring to the organisation should we keep? Should we keep all of it? Should we keep practically none of it? The point of having it partly is that we do bring the diversification, but the people who are managing that business are not necessarily creating any of the diversification. It's just there because it exists. The theoretical answer is that the marginal cost of capital to a business plan should be the marginal cost to the whole entity. I think that matters most when you're making quick decisions. So a good corporate loan book will actually try and make that explicit in the way in which they deal with a new corporate loan, because that will create further diversification or not for the business as a whole and for the credit risk as a whole. My view is you probably don't need to get that theoretical with major business lines, but it's important to understand the point and then decide how you're dealing with it. And I guess the other side of the balance sheet is making sure that the returns match the economic capital. So the measure of profit also needs to be consistent across the entities. So for long-term contracts, is the profit recognised up front or not? The answer to that is different across different types of business lines. Although accounting standards are getting more and more consistent, they're not necessarily completely consistent yet. So you'll find different business lines effectively, in an economic sense, having a different profit at a different stage of a contract. A topical one for those of us who have annuity books, credit spreads on annuity books are marked to market in a life insurance environment. Not similar kinds of contracts aren't necessarily marked to market. on a bank balance sheet because they're not traded? And then I guess how should tax be treated? Is tax a consideration in this kind of thing? I guess, again, perfect theoretical accuracy is less important than buy-in, but it's important to understand the differences so that you can decide how important they actually are in terms of the individual organisation. Because if one company basically doesn't get profit for something that adds economic value and another part of the company does, you don't necessarily want that to be the way in which they're measured. So it wouldn't be an actuarial presentation without a control cycle, so I thought I'd put one on. I guess, to me, economic capital is part of the control cycle of the whole organisation. We need to, first of all, start with risk appetite in the bottom right, work out what our risk appetite and confidence levels are, then review all the assumptions that we're making in developing what the economic capital is, and forecast what's going to happen to the business, both return and economic capital. So we're effectively forecasting the profit and the capital, and relating the two for the year. And then we manage the business and actually measure what happened. Now, that's an interesting part of the exercise, which is probably less done than you might expect in terms of, you know, we said this was the risk we're taking, let's have a look and see whether our risk appetite and the risk that we're taking actually matched. So why measure it? I guess my last picture is growing some money, that's the whole point. Risk and return must be measured together. I think economic capital is the way to do that. The process must be robust, and a common currency of risk and return will create good decision making. I've described a whole lot of theoretical issues between different balance sheets. I think that some of those have to be dealt with, some of them don't have to be dealt with but have to be understood so that you can actually use economic capital as a common currency. So that's all I had to say in my presentation. I guess over to you for comments and questions.
Thanks, Jennifer.
When I asked Jennifer how long she needed for a presentation, she said she didn't know, and then she said it for about a minute and said, oops, 25 minutes, and then she told me how many slides, and I said, no way, 30 minutes, and she's done 25 minutes, so there you go. I think that's a lesson, and the more you know about the subject, the better your forecasting is. Maybe we're just open for questions. Anyone want to respond or ask? There you go. Oh, thank you.
Tony, thanks. Jennifer, interested in your views on driving behaviour and how you drive behaviour. So a little preamble, if I may. I'm interested in what do you think does drive decisions and behaviour, such as KPIs and measures? How much of those need to be driven by economic capital to be effective? So you might have a KPI driven by revenue, volume, top line. You may have economic capital or something. And what proportion needs to be economic capital before that starts really driving decisions? And in your experience, what is the balance at the moment in organisations, and is it really working?
I think what I would say about the KPI is that if you have a KPI that looks at profit, it should be a profit after capital charge or return on target equity type of approach. So some measure of profit after the measure of risk. I think different people react to KPIs differently. It's not just a KPI issue, it's how do you measure the organisation. If every time you measure the organisation, the key number that everybody focuses on and asks questions about is a measure that has a profit after capital charge or some kind of return for risk, then that will drive the behaviour. It's not so much whether every individual's KPI has that in there or whether it's 5% or 20% or 50%, but whether the major measure that everyone looks at has that return for risk in it, would be my view. Interested in others?
Rob?
You've got a microphone.
Rob Daly. I'm asking a deliberately hard question, Jennifer, because I know you're up to it. I just look at various companies. AIG got mentioned at a presentation yesterday where one of their fatal flaws was their model didn't pick up collateralisation requirements on the various credit options they had. And there's other names who've been very successful at the forefront of risk management who haven't done very well recently. And I don't want to pick on any of them, but there's a whole heap of examples you could take. What do you think they're getting wrong? Or what did you think they got wrong? Did they not? I'm just going back to your earlier comment about the models perhaps not being as important as full implementation. But then I look back at some of these organisations that had pretty full implementation, and I suspect perhaps their models were wrong. So maybe give us some insight on that. Thanks, Jennifer.
I mean, I don't know any more about the ins and outs of some of those organisations than anyone else reading the press does. But I guess I do think that if you rely too much on the extreme tail of a model, which is what some of those organisations appear to have done, I saw a quote from somebody saying, what's happening is 30 standard deviations, so it's completely out of our experience, rather than it's a 30 deviation according to our model, surely that means the model's wrong. And I think too much reliance on theoretical model and not enough. The more you start looking at the tail of that model and starting relying on it, I think the more danger you can get into. So I guess that comes back to my caution about the tail. I don't think you should just throw out the model because people have relied on models and got it wrong. But I think you need to look at the model more carefully and understand its limitations, which people perhaps haven't done. But you know, I guess some of that stuff I am reading from, you know, I'm just reading the press like everyone else.
Economic capital is meant to be...
just before you go on, can we have your name, please?
My name is Piri Kolaraja from ING. Economic capital is meant to be the cutting-edge way to quantify risk and hold capital. How likely do you think our businesses in Australia could be regulated on economic capital? Because you talked about it being part of our DNA, and being part of our KPIs. And if we say we're going to hold capital on the regulatory basis and then use another set of capital to calculate profit after capital, it just doesn't seem like it's something that management would like to have, two sets of capital numbers. Can we get to a stage where our capital is held on the EC basis?
Probably if you'd asked me that 2 years ago, I would have said yes, but I suspect I'd say no now. I guess if you have the capital you hold based entirely on an internal model, then the regulators are placing an awful lot of trust in the people in that organisation to have got that internal model right and all the people who are reviewing it. But that said, I think in terms of managing the organisation within the organisation, getting the right price for risk within the organisation, it's never going to be as right using regulatory capital as it is using economic. You're always going to have some level of difference, but in most organisations, the regulatory capital really matters at the top. The economic capital should matter down to fairly discrete business lines, which don't particularly have to worry about regulatory capital if the regulatory capital at the top is managed appropriately.
Great.
Greg Martin, a couple of comments and questions, I suppose, Jennifer. You mentioned at the beginning that you said economic capital is not about regulatory capital, but I think I found in a lot of my work that given that we have a pretty much risk-based capital regime in life insurance and general insurance in Australia, that the two end up sort of pointing to similar sorts of answers all the time. So, the total answer tend to be too different, and if I could pluck a couple of examples out of my head that I know. If you take a capital adequacy in life insurance at 99.75, and then you say, talking to APRA and everything else, you don't want to be outside John Laker's office any more than once every 10 years, then you're out at least 90% on top of that. And, I know we've got lots of caveats around distributions, but by the time you do that, you're already up at 99.9596, which is oddly around about an A rating for S&P, and is not terribly different from Moody's or something, or not terribly different to where a bank 1 in 2,000 year event is. And so you're sort of all roads a little bit lead to Rome. The interesting point, though, I find is really the point I think you raised in your slide around allocation of capital and how you charge that, and that's been the most robust debates I've ever had, and in particular, who does get diversification benefits, and when you actually stop giving people diversification benefits is also a very interesting thing. As a block of business gets bigger and bigger and you start charging them marginally more and more capital, because from a risk perspective, that's actually when you're getting into trouble, is when you're getting bigger and bigger. So I don't know whether you've got any comments around that particular point. I was just probably not quite agree with your assessment that the banks and life and general insurance have got terribly different versions of 1 in 2,000 versus whatever. I think by the time you sort of... they can present it differently, like it's 1 in 200 times 3 or something, but it actually works out to be similar sorts of things. It's just a issue of how you get to it and how boards understand the risk profile. I think they're all out there past one in a thousand, I think, for any reputable organisation. And the only other comment I've got is around how you get there. And I think a lot of work we've been doing, we're finding it easier to explain and have discussions with boards and senior management if you take an approach that's more compound approach. So it's not one in a thousand, you've run out of your last dollar, therefore you're broke. In fact, you're broke in any practical sense way before that. And so it's more questions around, you know, one in 10 years, you don't want to have to raise capital in an adverse market and doing compound things. I think it tends to get away from some of the focusing on really extreme tails that aren't so easy to model or really understand.
I'm just not sure how many questions there are in there, Greg, but I think probably the regulatory and economic capital one I'd touch on. I think although we have a moderately risk-based capital basis for life and general insurers, it's not. It depends on the line of business how accurately that is reflecting the risk. So DAC's a bit of a sore point for life insurers. You know, should you give some credit for DAC in the life on the life insurance balance sheet? Regulatory capital doesn't. Some economic capital does. And that will tend to change the mix of business question than just using regulatory capital. But I think maybe we're agreeing more than we realised on the tail of the distribution point. Maybe I'm talking about actually people understanding what they're holding. The more you start talking about the very extremes of the distribution, the less people really understand what you've done. And it's some black box that spat out a number. And I think focusing on the shorter point of the distribution and realising that you're not going to get the tail right probably is a more robust way of managing the organisation, in my view.
We've got time for a couple more, I think.
Joel Wong. My question is sort of partly related to what Greg just said about, and it comes back to the tail. I mean, if you look at AIG, what happened at AIG, they didn't understand how the tail worked because they were riding very deeply out of money options. And so the behaviour of the tail actually was the key issue there. But if they had some sort of process of ensuring that they don't concentrate too much on a particular type of business, which is really what brought them undone, would that change the behaviour, do you think? Can you have some comment on how you actually manage that process? Because obviously things went horribly wrong.
Yeah.
But unless you understood that tail, how could you have managed it? So given that there's the chances of us understanding how the tail works is pretty slim, how could we actually put some other processes in place to ensure that the whole thing doesn't recur?
It's a good question, and I'm not sure that I'm sure there's many people around the world trying to answer it at the moment. I guess part of the issue is thinking that you understand the tail when you don't really. I think I'd rather be in an organisation where people really do understand that they don't properly understand the tail, and they need to understand it using other ways than a sophisticated model. Understanding the tail is probably more about thinking up weird and wonderful scenarios that might go wrong and how, whether you believe them or not, than expanding a statistical model out to the nth degree and doing 100,000 simulations rather than 1,000. So I guess I'm saying I would say you do need to understand the tail, but in a management sense and a scenario sense rather than in a statistical sense. But that said, I'm not sure that even that, if you haven't got the imagination to think through the scenarios, will stop you betting the business in a way that you haven't realised if you're not thinking it through. I come back to the, I think, scenario modelling at the tail is probably the key point.
I think we've got time for one more. Yep.
It's Richard Land. In terms of embedding KPIs, you might have a concept of return on economic capital, so you allow for your expected risk in your KPI. Your risk appetite might be that saying that we're going to accept that risk. We're not trying to hedge it out or do anything with it. At the end of the period, because of the nature of risk, the risk might have either happened or not happened. In embedding the risk, how do you allow for the various ranges of risk, which could quite validly happen under your risk appetite when comparing it with an overall expected level of risk, allowance of risk?
As a question, we've had this debate also internally, and I haven't actually put that up there. Particularly in the banking side, where risks only happen, you know, once every 10 or so years on the credit side, what some companies do actually do is just allocate the expected loss, which of course is very unpopular in a year, in most years, the 9 out of 10 years where you don't get the losses, and very, very popular in the 10th year when you've got all the losses. But in some ways, the trouble with that, though, is that you do have to really believe your model, and it doesn't necessarily drive the right underwriting behaviour to get the right risks on the balance sheet in the first place. You know, you're underwriting to the model rather than to what's actually going to happen. So I'm not sure what the right answer is, but it's something that's worth actually thinking about because, yes, you know, in a bad year, the risks happen and you shouldn't necessarily be penalised for doing what you should be doing.
I agree, because under that scenario, AIG might have accepted that risk. That's a very small risk in the actual year it actually happened. So allowing that risk adjusted, well, maybe they did achieve all their targets. Maybe they did get back.
That's tempting to finish there, but are there any other burning questions?
I'll point out that that's what actually happened, is they didn't get their bonus.
That might not be the end of the matter.
So just further reading, I've actually put this the paper up as a blog post. This is a site, ausrisk.net, which has various posts about risk in banking, life insurance and general insurance. So if you want to continue the discussion, please go there and add to comments. And I also want to give my thanks to Tim Gorst, Andrew Reynolds and John Evans, who provided valuable feedback on various drafts of that blog post. So thanks, everyone.
Okay, and if I can thank you all. Yeah.